From the Sky News Centre at 5, the mother of a 5-year-old British boy kidnapped in Pakistan insists it isn't an inside job. Pakistan's High Commissioner suggested someone in the family may have some sort of knowledge of what happened. Sahil Saeed was taken yesterday in the Punjab region with a £100,000 ransom demanded. His mother, Akila, at home in Oldham, says she can't achieve anything by travelling to Pakistan.
It's not easy to go out there. I want the government to do as much as it can. We can't do nothing at the moment until the government do something. Side of us going, I'm just not sure about it yet. I'm just scared.
The Prime Minister's told the Chilcot inquiry he met every request for military funding for the war following criticism the decisions he made as Chancellor cost lives. But Gordon Brown did express regret over failures to plan properly for the aftermath. He said his role was to make sure the funding was there for what we had to do.
I said that every single request that was made for equipment had to be met, and every request was met. And at any point, the military commanders were able to ask for equipment that they needed. And I know of no occasion when they were turned down for it.
A soldier jailed for publicly refusing to serve a second tour of duty in Afghanistan plans to appeal against his 9-month jail sentence. Lance Corporal Joe Glenton was told by a military court in Colchester he would also be reduced in rank. 12 members of a gang which made millions from skunk cannabis are facing jail. The drugs were hidden in lorries delivering flowers to Britain from Holland. MPs have hit out at plans by Parliament's new expenses watchdog to scale back their entitlements. The Independent Parliamentary Standards Authority wants to scrap the resettlement grant for retiring MPs and stop MPs buying homes with mortgages subsidised by the taxpayer. The 9/11 terror attacks and Harry Potter are top of a list of online news searches over the last 15 years. Yahoo says the deaths of Michael Jackson and the Australian conservationist Steve Irwin were also popular topics. That's the latest. I'm Bill Bingham.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
It seemed too good to be true.
A flight leaves on Monday.
10 weeks making a difference in countries like South Africa, India and Peru.
They need a block of toilets building for their village.
Thousands of 18 to 25 year olds from the UK.
And I don't have to pay for the flights, food, accommodation, vaccinations.
What? How do you manage that? Who pays?
Platform 2. Volunteering abroad for 18 to 25-year-olds who've always wanted to help out overseas but couldn't afford it. Funded by the Department for International Development. No need to use life savings or have rich parents. If you're 18 to 25 and have or are eligible for a UK passport, go to myplatform2.com or phone 0800-988-6828.
Wow, myplatform2.com or 0800-988-6828.
It's no movie fantasy. Platform 2, your platform to change your world.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
On Mondays at 5, it's Tom Bigwood. Tuesdays, it's Dan and Laura. Wednesdays, Jade Pangyang. Thursdays, it's Phil Gibbons. But Fridays... Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and our guest this week to discuss some of the big stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, The Secret of Oz, a new film from the United States, looks at the financial allegories contained in the famous book by William Baum, The Wizard of Oz, and asks, are there lessons for today's financial crisis? And Montpellier-based Falklands veteran Richard Cowley will be here to ask, what is the difference between a soldier and a terrorist? That's in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but first here's our two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend... temperatures averaging around 5 degrees Celsius in the daytime, dry and sunny. And doesn't it feel great? It almost feels like spring has sprung this week. Next week, we're looking at temperatures around 5 degrees Celsius again, a dry week again with plenty of sunny spells. Next weekend, that's the 13th and 14th of March, averaging 7 up a bit more, dry again with sunny spells. That sounds great, doesn't it, over the next couple of weeks? And that was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news, and joining us today is Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows. Welcome to Drive Time, Chris.
Oh, thank you for that, and good afternoon to everybody.
Now, are you yourself from Bristol?
I am indeed. I was born in Bristol. I was born in the Ashley Ward quite a few years ago, but I'd rather not actually say how many.
Okay. Now, what about your day job, or are you retired?
I'm retired.
And what did you do sort of before?
I ran my own business for 31 years. But I was actually trained as a scientist, as a an analytical chemist. But I've done many jobs in the city, one of which was driving the big green buses around the city in the days when they were green, and there was lots of them.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about your company that you ran.
The company I ran originally was a hygiene and security firm. I dealt with lots of the larger companies. I didn't make very much money, but I quite enjoyed what I was doing. I did this for quite a long time, and then I decided to go a little bit out, if you like. I moved to North Somerset, and for 11 years I ran a retail business, which was a home improvement building, that sort of thing.
Okay, so back to your work on the City Council.
Right.
What committees are you on?
I'm on two scrutiny commissions. One is Health and Adult Community Care, and the other one is Community Cohesion. They're both important commissions. I particularly am interested in the health one because I've been involved in health as a volunteer for many years in the city. I quite enjoy what I do. I quite enjoy being able to ask sometimes searching questions.
Okay, you're saying you're doing health as a volunteer. What kind of thing?
It was public and patient involvement originally, which I was eventually became chair of that. I was also chair of the Bristol Health Services Plan working group, which had quite big ramifications, really, for the city and for the greater Bristol area.
Okay, what about your work on community cohesion? What are you doing there? Can you tell us some of the stuff you're up to at the moment?
One of the most important things I feel that we're doing at the moment is attempting to tackle people trafficking. In my opinion, it's modern slavery. It's very, very important. Bristol is one of the biggest centres, apparently, and we need to do something about it. We invite people to come to our city. Bristol has always been welcoming to people from all over the place, different places. But unfortunately, when they get here, they could very well end up almost as abused as the place that they've escaped from. So we need to do a lot about that.
So if we know it's going on, why aren't the police intervening?
It's very difficult because some of the people that are involved in this are far from nice. There's a lot of money that's involved in this, and wherever there's a lot of money, there can be a lot of nasty people who want to get their hands on it or keep their hands on it if they've already got it. People are threatened. People are frightened to say anything. People need somewhere safe, a safe refuge. But unfortunately, a safe refuge needs to be really safe. And I'm talking sometimes about it being bulletproof. It's that bad.
So are you looking to the end of 2010? Do you think we may see some improvements in that this year?
We have asked City Council to treat this as a priority, and I believe that the Cabinet are looking at it very, very carefully, and we have great hopes that they will tackle this. There are some officers that have already been set up to start things moving.
But no promises yet? I suppose it's difficult to get promises on a subject like that.
Well, I can't promise anything because I'm not important enough and I haven't got the power, but hopefully there will be some action on it very soon.
Okay. Now, are you happy with this year's council tax settlement?
No. No, I'm not. I think that it could have been a smaller settlement. I would have liked to have gone for 1%, not 2%. I feel that hard times, which is what we've got at the moment, mean that there are hard decisions.
Do you think that the money the council collects in council tax has been spent reasonably wisely?
Not everywhere. It's all about priorities, isn't it? My priorities are probably different to the priorities of the ruling party.
Okay, now Martin Summers is here too. He's our old Labour economics expert and pundit who joins us every week here. Martin, a certain Mr. Karadzic's trial has resumed at the International Criminal Court in The Hague this week. Who is he?
Well, I suppose I'm being asked to speak about this because I used to be an aid worker
in
Bosnia.
You actually were out in Bosnia, weren't you?
I was in Bosnia during the war, yes, I was out there. Karadzic was one of the leaders of the Republika Srpska, which was the breakaway Serbian section of Bosnia. And he's been put on trial at The Hague, so I don't want to prejudice anything about the trial by presuming his guilt, because that's not the point. But he is suspected, I'll put it no more strongly than that, of being the black hand behind an awful lot of misbehaviour, including the Srebrenica massacre.
Politically, what was he up to during the conflict? Can you just give us an idea?
Well, I think
for many people, the former Yugoslavia is a bit of a muddle.
Well, it was more muddling when you got close up to it, I can tell you. I mean, basically, he was a bigot, and he didn't like Muslims, and he didn't like people who weren't like him. And, you know, he justifies himself by saying that the Muslims were out to get them, which I think is grossly exaggerated. I mean, there was bad behaviour on all sides, but, you know, that's projecting onto other people your own ill attitude. I hope he gets what he deserves in The Hague.
Right, okay, well, let's now move on to take a look at some of this week's stories. And let's start with the big story today, which is Gordon Brown, who's defended his decision to invade Iraq today, giving his evidence at the Chilcot inquiry. The Prime Minister expressed his sadness for the loss of life in the conflict, but he insisted it had been necessary for the international community to confront Saddam Hussein. Mr. Brown was Chancellor at the time of the Iraq invasion.
I met the intelligence services on a number of occasions during the course of 2002 and early 2003. And in addition to my discussions in the cabinet, and in addition to my discussions with Tony Blair himself, I was given information by the intelligence services which led me to believe that Iraq was a threat that had to be dealt with by the actions of the international community. Of course, at all points, we wish the diplomatic road to be successful. So throughout 2002 and early 2003, we were hopeful that the diplomatic route and the 1441 at the United Nations would bring Iraq to a sense that they had to cooperate and they had to disclose, as well as dismantle whatever weapons they had. But the information that we had was information given to us by the intelligence authorities.
So you would agree with Mr. Straw, who I think told the inquiry that the case for military action stood or fell on whether Iraq posed a threat on international peace and security by reasons of his weapons of mass destruction? Would you agree with that?
Well, my thesis is this, that persistently Iraq had been asked by the international community to disclose and then dismantle weapons that every country who signed that United Nations resolution believed that they had, that we had a responsibility to ensure that international law in this case was upheld, and the international community would mean very little if we could not, in the case of a country that had systematically was in fact a serial violator of international law, we would have no sense that the political will would be there for future interventions which may be necessary if we could not show that we could come together to deal with the problem of Iraq. But of course, what we wanted was a diplomatic route to succeed, and right up to the last minute and right up to that last weekend, I think many of us were hopeful that diplomatic route could succeed.
So your concern was mainly about the breach of the United Nations resolutions.
His
defiance by Saddam Hussein with those resolutions that you felt was a reason.
Yes, my view has always been throughout this this episode that the sanctions and then the no-flight zones and then the tightening of sanctions and then, of course, the demand that Iraq disclosed to the international community what it had and what it was doing. This was all about the implementation of a new international set of rules that were necessary in a post-Cold War world, that we'd already seen how much instability could be caused by individual states that were either failed states or rogue states, as well as seen the effect of terrorism and the action of non-state actors in terrorism, that we had essentially failed in Rwanda to take action where it was necessary. We had tried hard in the Balkans to take action that was required, but 14 resolutions of the United Nations had been systematically violated and ignored by Iraq, and it was our responsibility to make sure that the international order could work for the future.
That's Gordon Brown there speaking at the Chilcot inquiry today. And I'd just like to get both of you's comments, maybe you first, Chris. What do you think of Gordon Brown's performance?
I thought he came across as a very able politician, quite frankly. Whether or not he answered the questions that the people wanted answered, that's a matter of opinion, of course.
Martin?
Well, I mean, as I've said on many times on this programme, I don't support the policy. I think it was the wrong thing to do. He said it's the right thing to do because that's what he decided to do, and that's what he's going to say, isn't it?
Well, he's saying, essentially, that it was the intelligence people that gave them the information.
Well, I dispute that. I mean, Scott Ritter, who was the UN weapons inspector and also an undercover CIA agent, he said that from 1981 onwards, I was telling my bosses in the Pentagon they've got nothing. And every time they said, go back and have another look, I said, I've already looked. They haven't got anything. And he was the lead inspector. And that's what the intelligence community were telling them all along. So I don't, this stuff about our intelligence people were telling them they got weapons of mass destruction, I don't believe that, actually.
Now, the armed forces are pretty much divided into the intelligence arm and operational arm. Doesn't this mean what's happened here in Iraq, that the operational arm is now very difficult for them to rely on the intelligence they're getting, Chris?
Yes, I suppose it is. But then intelligence, as Gordon Brown said earlier today, is a subjective thing. You make of it what you will. My own opinion is that the whole thing was wrong because it was a decision which was then had facts added to it to make the decision appear to be correct.
And do you agree, as Gordon Brown was saying there, that Saddam Hussein was a serial violator of international law?
Well, you certainly gave two fingers to the international community. I think he liked to give the impression that he was more important than he really was, and I think that the Americans had their own agenda, and we were dragged into it by the Americans. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
I mean, if you'd been in that cabinet room making that decision, well, would you have spoken out against it, you think, at the time?
Yes, I think I would. I would always speak out in favour of diplomacy against sending people to war.
Because Gordon Brown was saying that he felt that the whole diplomacy route was exhausted.
Well, that's, of course, is Gordon Brown's opinion, and obviously the opinion of most of the cabinet, but not all the cabinet, of course.
Now, Robin Cook resigned, and he said, I just don't agree with this, and that was a principal decision by him, I think.
OK, let's go on to have a look at our next story. And Gordon Brown, we stay with Gordon, and our Prime Minister, and he wants to stop the courts issuing arrest warrants, we hear this week, for war criminals. The government is to announce plans to stop politically motivated, as it calls them, campaign groups using British courts to secure arrest warrants for visiting foreign officials. The move follows an outcry over a series of attempts to detain high-profile figures using during trips to London, including Zippy Livni, former Israeli foreign minister. Under the proposals, the Crown Prosecution Service will take over responsibility for prosecuting war crimes and other violations of international law. It will end the current system in which magistrates are obliged to consider a case for an arrest warrant published or presented by any individual. Martin, do you want to start on this? Is this a move forward? Because it does sound as if this is the Crown Prosecution Service really taking over the role which has traditionally been given to magistrates.
Well, I mean, that's a rather technical point. I think, coming back to what we were saying earlier about the Iraq war and Karadzic and so on, there's either a rule of law or there isn't a rule of law. And it's not for the elected government to interfere in what the courts do when they're trying to carry through their role as enforcers of the law. That would be my basic view on this.
And Chris, what are your thoughts?
I think it's very difficult with international arrest warrants. And my own feeling is that if people have broken British law, then they should be made to appear before the courts and be judged accordingly. However, if they're visiting this country, some of whom will be visiting on having diplomatic status, it starts to make things very, very messy indeed. I think, really, that they should leave things as they are.
Okay, I mean, because this is contrasts quite a bit with Radovan Karadzic, who's at the Hague at the moment.
Yes, and isn't Saddam
it?
Hussein and all the rest of it, and they've got to be held to account. Blah blah blah. But when the decision goes against us, oh well, it's raison d'état. Now we've either got if we're going to push these principles, we've got to stick to them, and it's got to be cut across the board. Yeah, you know, whoever is misbehaving, and we said to Saddam Hussein, Brown was quoted at the beginning of the show, you've broken international law, and that's the justification for our action against you. Now we can't, at the same breath, be giving Ejup Ganic, former Bosnian president, has been remanded to Wandsworth. He's another Karadzic. He's a Muslim, but he's accused of atrocities. He's got to be dealt with. We've got to establish a rule of law.
Well, I mean, for example, with Saddam Hussein, one of the things I don't understand is how come he was dealt with within the Iraqi court system rather than brought to The Hague like Karadzic has been.
The reason for that is obvious, because his defence would be, you, for example, if he was accused of doing chemical weapons, he'd say, yeah, but you sold me the stuff. Call Paul Wolfowitz. That's why he couldn't be tried at the Hague, and that's why the US isn't signed up to the Hague, because they know very well that their generals and politicians might have to go there.
So it doesn't sound like we've got a level playing field, does it?
But there is another side to this. I'm old enough to recall a number of people who I think a lot of the world would consider to be war criminals, actually appearing in this country later on and being feted even by the royal family, because it suited the people involved to do that. So, you know, today you're a war criminal, tomorrow you're a hero. I have a very, very mixed view on this.
It doesn't really sound like the rule of law, though, does it? I mean, you know, if we're picking and choosing who we want to live up to that standard.
Yeah, I agree. It should be a level playing field in every sense.
Okay, well, we're pretty agreed on that. Okay, pay as you throw is our next story, a local story which made the national news. Bristol City Council is to launch a pilot scheme that could pave the way for national bin taxes. Although this was spun rather differently in the local press, we hear here, if Bristol gets the go-ahead, this will be the first council to provide cash incentives for people who cut the amount of rubbish they send to landfill. Well, obviously that means that people who don't will have to pay more. Do you think this is a positive initiative by the City Council, Chris?
No, I don't, to be perfectly honest with you. I think they're approaching it from the wrong side. If they really wanted to do something about the huge amounts of rubbish that are being generated, they should start where the rubbish starts. And in the main, that's with the manufacturers and the packaging companies. Start with them. Bring some rules in as far as they're concerned, because it's very, very difficult. If you buy anything, you very often find that it's got an awful lot of packaging which sometimes is very difficult to actually flatten down.
I must say, I mean, most of the stuff that goes into my rubbish bin rather than the recycling is plastic. Mm-hmm. And it seems that's the one thing that the doorstep bin collectors don't collect.
Yeah, I do hear that there is a pilot scheme being started in part of my ward, actually, to do the pavement plastic collections. I don't know the full details about that. I only heard it an hour or so ago. That seems to be a sensible move, but I still think that it's the generators of this rubbish that should be attacked first.
Well, that's another scoop for this programme. It's a special plastic collection in your area, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, Martin, what are your thoughts on rubbish?
Well, I'd just like to agree with what Chris said. I think the problem is that the council, of course, doesn't have power over the packaging of multinational companies. I mean, it's got something. If you're going to change packaging regulations, you've got to do it on a national basis. And one simple thing that you could do, which has been done in Ireland, they just banned plastic bags. Banned. We don't have plastic bags.
But
if you go to the shop, you've got to take a bag with you.
So don't you think that possibly the central government has failed to deal with the big companies that are actually producing this packaging? So they've sort of foisted this onto local government and said, oh, I'll tell you what, we can't deal with the big companies that are producing all this packaging, so the poor old consumer's going to have to pay again.
Well, that's right, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that there's a lot of sympathy for the view that it's central government should take some action as far as packaging is concerned. I mean, how many people out there have tried to perhaps unpack an item that's had this stiff plastic packaging on it and managed to slice their finger before they've got anywhere near unpacking the item? That's the sort of thing that makes people cross. But The real thing is we need to take a totally new approach. And the only way some of the big companies are going to do this, and some of them are international companies, is if the government, the central government, forces them to do it.
Well, now, there's another aspect to this, because we're also hearing that spy chips are hidden in 2.5 million dustbins now. That's 60% rise this year in electronic bugs, as council snoopers plan pay-as-you-throw tax. So this is actually the stealth tax on rubbish, which we throw away. And more than 2.5 million homes now have wheelie bins fitted with microchips to weigh their contents. This is an increase of nearly two-thirds in just a year. The bins, which can be electronically identified and weighed, are designed for pay-as-you-throw rubbish tax schemes. Now, this is another aspect to all this, having the little chips in there to weigh how much you've got. Is this a good use of technology?
No, I don't think so. I think this is just another example of Big Brother, quite frankly.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because Alex Dean of Big Brother Watch was asked by, I think it's the Daily Mail, about this subject. He said the number of local councils placing microchips in bins is increasing, despite the fact that only one of them has volunteered to trial the government's pay-as-you-throw scheme. So it sounds like these chips are sitting there without actually doing very much. The councils are waiting until the public aren't watching to begin surveillance on our waste habits, including into people's private lives and introducing punitive taxes on what we throw away. The British public doesn't want this technology, these fines, or this intrusion. If local authorities have no intention to monitor our waste, then they should end the surreptitious installation of these bin microchips. Now, isn't that just being a little bit paranoid? And maybe he's a bit of a Luddite, this chap.
There's an old expression which I've quoted for many, many years, and I'll quote it now on air. Just because you're paranoid, it doesn't mean they're not out to get you.
But at the end of the day, surely this is going to mean that people, rather than throw rubbish away, are going to be fly-tipping it. They're going to be leaving it out in the countryside and getting rid of it, so they don't have to pay any extra tax for the rubbish to be taken away.
Well, not the citizens like you and I, and most of the listeners to this particular radio station, but there are people out there who will find it difficult to get rid of their rubbish, and they will break the law, and they will make life uncomfortable and unpleasant for all of us. So I don't think this is good thinking.
Well, the Big Brother Watch agree with you, because they're also warning that collection of data from chip bins could also show when households are on holiday, opening the way to abuse by criminals. Martin, what about you in your waste habits? Is this going to affect you at all?
I was just thinking, there's no chip in my bin. It's got no lid on it. Well, I mean, if you want people to do things, it's often better to encourage them rather than punish them. You know, every teacher knows that praise is much better than
blame. Well,
that's
what they're saying here, is they're going to give a discount if you have hardly any rubbish in your bin.
I know, and I've seen documentaries on the TV about Okinawa in Japan, where people literally, they really do sort their rubbish out, and they're trying to get absolutely zero waste. And that's because of the Japanese kind of culture, that when they say, hey, we're going to do something about this, people get on the case and they do it. The British are much more kind of happy-go-lucky, but you can't make the same coat fit different people. This is the sort of thing that gets British people's backs up. We know it does, and it's not unlikely to make them change their behaviour in a positive way.
Yes, but Martin, Bristol is leading the way.
Well, maybe it's not going to be as bad as suggested, but I would hope that people should do the right thing because it is the right thing, and not because they're being given carrots or sticks about it.
Yeah, it does sound like the technology is there, and as it's there, it's almost bound to be used.
But it sounds as if it's a waste of money. They're not even using the technology. They know there's so much resistance to it that they've put the technology in the bins, which has cost God knows what, but they're not actually going to end up using it. What a waste of time.
Okay, well, it's 5:30, just about now, just coming up to anyway, and time to take a break from our news review to hear our guest Chris Window's choice of music. Chris, what is the song and why did you choose it?
Well, I chose this song because it means something to me, also means something to my wife. It's an older hit, shall we say. It's just something that I really enjoy, and I think it echoes. It's the title is Endless Love. I expect it's familiar to those of you, listeners who have been around for a little while.
You're doing a great job as a DJ there. Carry on. Yeah.
My love, there's only life, the only thing that's right. My first love, you're every breath that I take, you're every step I
Love there with Lionel Richie and Diana Ross, chosen by today's guest on BCFM's 93.2's Friday Drive Time, Chris Windows, councillor for Henbury. We're running an online survey at the moment, which gives me a perfect excuse to mention the BCFM website if you're on broadband. That's at www.bcfm.org.uk. And it really does only take 5 minutes. You can also do lots more on the website, get volunteer forms, submit programme ideas, see the schedule or listen again. That's at bcfm.org.uk. And if you can, please do our online survey. Now, back to our review of the week's news. And we're going to have a little look now at a local and national story about the Bristol plane spotters, not swatters, spotters, who were fined by a court in India. Two Bristol plane spotters today have been fined £25,000 each That's about £365 by an Indian court after admitting illegally monitoring aircraft. You may remember earlier on in the week there was a court hearing where the Indian magistrate was off sick, so they had to postpone it. Stephen Hampton, 46, and Stephen Ayres, 56, both from Bristol, appeared before magistrates in Delhi charged with intercepting communications. They've been now told that over the next few days they will certainly be allowed to return back to the UK soon once they've paid the fine. Chris, what are your thoughts about this kind of... I mean, these chaps have gone over there on holiday, it seems. Are they spies?
Well, I don't think they're spies, and I don't think that the Indian government thought that they were spies, but it does send a message out, and it's a salutary warning that if you're going to a foreign country, you should remember that their rules are very often different to our rules, and that some countries don't suffer fools gladly. It seems to me rather foolish for them not to have made themselves known to the authorities before they did anything.
Martin?
Yeah, that's the obvious thing they should have done. I mean, if plane spotting's allowed in India, they'll say, right, you can stand over here and spot the planes. But if you're just taking photographs of planes without explaining what you're doing, you could be a terrorist, couldn't you? That's what terrorists would do.
You could be a plane spotter.
No, but I mean, the point is that means that they've got to make... that there's a whole security thing they have to go in just to check that you are a plane spotter and not a terrorist, and that's what the fine represents, is the bother that they've had to go to.
Can't plane spotters just go and spot planes anymore?
No.
I mean, this is a hobby.
You can, but you've got to identify what you're doing to the authorities. You go and knock on the door and say, excuse me, please, can I watch your planes? And they say yes or no, and if they say no,
well,
you can't.
If you're outside the perimeter of an airport, say you're in a hotel or something, why haven't you got the right just to take a photograph if you want to?
Well, you can have a go if you like, but then they're going to come and say, hey, you might be a terrorist, we're arresting you.
Yeah, but you might not. You know, this is part of the problem, isn't it, that we've got here a presumption of guilt. These guys have been hauled through the courts for doing what is potentially, and obviously most people here believe, that they've just gone out there as slightly nerdy plane spotters, but certainly that shouldn't be a crime, should it?
Yeah, well, come on. I mean, let's be fair about this. They didn't approach it in the right fashion. Anybody that acts in a suspicious fashion, and quite obviously these guys seemed to be acting suspiciously to the Indian officials, and the Indian officials did the right thing. They stopped them. I mean, just think, if they had been terrorists and they had shot down a plane and there had been a number of British passengers on board who regrettably were killed, then think of the outcry here. Why didn't the Indian authorities do something about it?
Yeah, but they didn't have anything to shoot the plane down with. All they had was cameras.
Yes, I know, but the point is, they should have asked, and it says in the article here, the men's arrest on the 15th of February came just 2 days after a bomb blast at a German bakery in Pune, the first major strike of its kind in India since the deadly Mumbai attacks in November 2008. In India, there's a real problem with random terrorism by all sorts of different groups with different political agendas. It's very, very serious. They've got a lot of problems trying to keep on top of it. And they can't be doing with Brits wandering around thinking that they're in Brighton. It's just not on, you know.
Well, one of the things that also I have to introduce into this is that plane spotters have actually done immense favours to people like Amnesty International by spotting aircraft that have been involved in these illegal...
extraordinary rendition at Glasgow Airport. Yeah, but the point is those plane spotters at Glasgow Airport who were spotting that were known to the authorities, they knew what the rules were, they're allowed to spot the planes.
So are you actually saying that even in this country, if you want to be a plane spotter, you've got to go and get some sort of special endorsement?
I think you certainly do as we speak at the moment. I mean, people can't just go around taking photographs of the transport infrastructure. The police will arrest you if you try and
do
it.
No, they won't, Martin. That's absolutely not true. If as a photographer, you're an absolute right to take a photograph in a public place. And the police have tried this. In fact, some community support officers have tried this in London. People have taken pictures of transport infrastructure in London, and then they've actually been reprimanded officially by the police for saying that, ordering tourists, for example, to delete their pictures on their cameras. Now, this is quite an important freedom that is being infringed here on the say-so that someone might be a terrorist when there's actually no real evidence to say that they are. Anyway, I'm interested in both of your views on that one, because I completely disagree with you. I think people should be able to take photographs in public places of anything. If you can see it there, then why shouldn't you be able to take a photograph of it?
I think there's one last point I'd make there and say that I think that they were quite lucky that they were fined that relatively small amount in as far as our currency is concerned, and that there are some places in the world where they'd be shot.
Okay.
I don't think we can approve of that, but yes, so it's obviously they've got to think about that before they do
something. I don't approve of it, but it wouldn't stop it happening in some places. No.
Okay, well, let's move on to another local story here. This one didn't make the national news, or international news. A public march to protest at plans to sell off one of Portishead's remaining high street farms has been cancelled. This was in yesterday's Bristol Evening Post, after police warned organisers that they could be prosecuted if it went ahead. Mum of two, Rita Baker, 37, had organised a march for this Saturday, that's tomorrow, to protest at plans by Bristol City Council to sell off Court House Farm. Now, a policeman telephoned her and told her that she wasn't allowed to have a march, and if she did, she might be prosecuted, so it'd have to be cancelled. Something to do with the fact that she hadn't applied for something called a road closure order. Now, this does seem to be the police interfering in, actually what is a potentially just a local peaceful protest. What are both of your thoughts on this one?
Okay, well, somebody that lived for a while in Portishead, I have to say that I have sympathy with the people that don't want the farm closed. At the same time, I've got sympathy with the police who have to ensure that safety is paramount.
And what about with the council who has decided they want to sell off this farm?
Well, I'm nothing to do with those councillors. I've got enough problem with the ones.
Well, I know it's ones over in Portishead, but you know, for years and years, city councils and county councils used to have small holdings, allotments, and farms which they would rent out to people to get into farming. Do you think that those days are completely gone, and that the council's right over there to be just selling these off? But it's a kind of selling off the family silver, isn't it?
It is, and I can't speak specifically on the Portishead issue. All I can say is that in Bristol, where I am a councillor, I'm very concerned about the plans to sell off lots and lots of green spaces, including in my own ward. And I'm very disturbed that the actual details of the areas that are being considered have been withheld until after the local elections.
Well, according to the Evening Post and Rita Baker, who's organised this protest for tomorrow, this farm actually is owned by Bristol City Council.
Ah.
So I don't know quite why.
Even though it's in Portishead.
Even though it's over in Portishead, yeah. So we shall see. Anyway, the other important information, bit of information here is that there will be a protest. It's just not going to be a march down the street. It's going to be, I think, at 11 a.m. Tomorrow, actually, in the precinct on Portishead High Street. They're just going to have like a little rally, vigil, maybe a few speakers and that kind of thing. But they're not actually going to be marching down the street.
Can I just comment on that? We've had quite a lot of protests in Bristol, particularly about the war. And there was a big debate within the Stop the War group about how much cooperation people did or did not want to have with the police. And it was quite a difficult discussion because some people didn't want to talk to the police at all and other people said, well, why don't we talk to them? But in actual fact, we've come to a perfectly reasonable compromise with the police, which is that we pretty much tell them what we're doing and they just basically let us do it. I think it's a shame that the police didn't allow this to go ahead. If people care about something, it's a local issue. They should make an effort to facilitate that protest rather than saying you haven't played by the book, because it's the spirit of the thing that matters more than the letter of the law, you know.
Well, according to Rita Baker, it was not until Tuesday that she received a call from North Somerset Police Sector Inspector John Owen saying the march had to be cancelled.
Well, you know what would happen in Bristol if the police tried to ban a Stop the War march? It would go ahead anyway. That's what would happen.
Well, I think to a degree I've got a lot of sympathy with that view, because I think in the country we live in, we've always enshrined the right to protest about things that we felt were wrong. To protest against things that our politicians were perhaps perceived to be forcing upon us when we didn't want them. So I would like to see as many of these protests go ahead, as long as it's safe, as long as it doesn't put...
Yeah, it's a traffic issue.
Yeah.
Okay, just to reiterate that there will be actually, rather than a march, there will be a rally at the precinct in Portishead High Street at 11 a.m. tomorrow. Now, our reporter Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week, and her question for you, the public, has been, do the people of Bristol like Nick Clegg? This is the leader of the Liberal Democrats Party. So what we'll do is we'll just hear now from Marina Morris and see what you had to say.
What do you think of Nick Clegg, the leader of the Liberal Democratic Party?
Yes, he seems very nice. No, I won't be voting for them. I vote Conservative. I haven't really heard much of him, but as far as I know, he seems to be okay. Yeah, he seems a nice man. I don't actually vote for any of the major parties. I usually vote for the Green Party. So yeah,
I think he's a good representative of the Liberal Democrats, but I think he probably lacks the stature of some of the more senior politicians, say in the Labour government. So I think he's a good spokesman for the party, but I'm not sure whether he has the level of charisma that's really required in one of the main political parties. I actually support the Liberal Democrats myself, and I know there are a lot of figures in there who would also, Vince Cable for instance, who would actually give a better account of the Liberal Democrats to the electorate.
Well, to be honest with you, I think they're all much of the same. Not a lot, to be honest. I'm Labour, so I don't really know a great deal.
I don't really like him or the main leaders of the other parties, to be quite honest. To be honest, I haven't really looked much into the general election this year. I feel like I'd rather have a no vote, so that I can register that I don't want to vote for any of them. I suppose they don't anymore. I guess they had Lloyd George back then in the day, and he was a character. But nowadays, like Nick Clegg, I don't really know who he is. I'm pretty sure most of the population don't know. They'll probably agree with me, or a lot of people I know would agree that he is the same as Cameron or Brown, and there's not much difference between them. Like, no matter how their policies might vary, they're only small variations. Yeah, I think you just need a big character, someone charismatic, who could actually take this country forward, do something good with it, but people like that aren't standing up, unfortunately.
I think the Liberal Democratic Party might be the most fair party, and I like Nick Clegg, but I don't know if I'd vote for him because they're never going to get in power, and I think it might be a wasted vote.
What do you know or think of the Liberal Democrats and their policies?
Well, I mean, I know quite a lot about the history of the Liberal Democrat Party. I think that they are probably one of the more socially responsible parties. I think the Labour Party and the Conservative Party have both been tainted by, you know, decades of you know, scandals and poor political decision-making. So I think I find the Liberal Democrats quite refreshing, and their policies to be... although the policies may not necessarily work, I find them refreshing to see that somebody is thinking outside the box, almost. I think not just at the moment, but I think it is raising. I mean, they've got more seats now in the House of Parliament than they have had probably since the 20s. I think it is gaining, and also I think some of the senior Liberal Democrats are helping to build on their reputation with the electorate. I mean, I think it was a long time ago, and I think a lot of people have forgotten the kind of the impression of the Liberal Democrats as being the joke, almost.
It tends to be sort of the main two parties, which is Labour and Conservative, that people vote for. They are still sort of in the background, unfortunately. Yeah, so again, it's just a case of waiting and see, really.
I think it's either Labour or Conservative. I don't know, I think that's always the way it's been, really. I think it's hard, really, to get anything different apart from Labour or Conservative, really. Politics isn't my strong, I'm just Labour through and through, so I tend to concentrate on them a lot. Not too sure, really.
I still don't think they're going to get in power. No, they don't have enough national credibility.
Well, there was the views of you, the people of Bristol, on the streets last week, speaking to our Marina Morris. Now, joined in the studio by Chris Windows and Martin Summers. Chris, do you want to start? What was your reaction to what you heard just there? Because it wasn't really a ringing endorsement, was it?
No, not really. I thought it was quite interesting. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, as a citizen of Bristol, I'm glad that Nick Clegg is the leader of the Liberal Party. I mean... I would have been much more worried if it had been somebody more substantial.
What did you think of the previous leader, Charles Kennedy, then?
I thought he was a very nice chap.
But that's actually what many of the people were there were saying about Nick Clegg, but that's not quite enough, is it?
Not really. Not really. Nice chaps are good to go and have a drink with. But we need somebody who's got a bit of a steel rod in them to actually run the country.
Martin?
Well, I think that the Liberals are looking to get one of their best results in a long time. All the pundits are now talking about a potential for hung parliament, and the Liberals are going to have to decide if there is a hung parliament, which side of the fence they're going to jump. I think this is turning into one of the most interesting elections we've seen in Britain in a generation. I don't particularly think Nick Clegg is a very effective leader of his party. He doesn't have the charisma that's the feeling one gets about him. I mean, Vince Cable, for example, is an older generation, and that's why they didn't choose somebody like him, because he's supposedly over the hill. But I think he's a much more serious, robust performer. But I think we could see Vince Cable as Chancellor of the Exchequer in either a Labour or a Conservative coalition government. So this is absolutely fascinating.
Now, this is something which I've heard talked about this week for the first time for a long time, is this idea of a caretaker government. Because I can remember back in the 1970s hearing this as a child and thinking, what on earth is a caretaker government? But that's because if there is a hung parliament, it takes quite a while, doesn't it, to, as we had in Bristol here a few years ago, to actually sort out an administration, someone to run the country or run the city, if nobody has a clear majority. So can you imagine what that will be like, Chris?
Well, it's not good if it really happens. I mean, it's interesting to think that the latter end of last year, people were talking about a hanged parliament, and now they're talking about a hung parliament. I don't think a hung parliament is good for the country. I think there needs to be a clear mandate for whoever the country wants, a clear mandate to carry out policies. And let's be fair about it. It's going to be a very, very difficult time for whoever is in charge of the country. There's some very difficult decisions to be made.
If there is a hung parliament, would it mean that the country's in a sort of state of paralysis?
No, I don't think. I'm much more sanguine about a hung parliament. We call it a hung parliament, but it's just normal politics in the rest of Northern Europe. What it means is that people have to sit down and thrash out some kind of shared agenda, and given the serious state of the economy and all the things that we've got to deal with, it might be quite useful for the parties to have to actually sit down and say, well, what have we all got in common that we can agree on that can allow us to go forward? Because the first thing they'll have to agree on is how a second election might be fought under what kind of electoral system. I mean, for political anoraks, I think this is fascinating. But of course, you know, for those who are less keen on this stuff, it's not so exciting. But I think it offers the possibility of opening up British politics, because it's all got very stuck in the rut. And we need to change our game. We need to what I call Southern Hemisphere politics. We've got to change the speed of the game. We've got to change the way we play. We've got to change the way we choose the teams. And that's what we've got to do. That's modernisation. And that's what I would hope will come out of the election.
I can't agree with that, obviously. From my previous comments, I still maintain that it's a bad thing for the country not to have a clear mandate. I think that I don't think we should be in the state that we're in now. But to have a hung parliament to follow that, I think is making things even worse.
But I mean, if you were listening to what the Vox Pop people were saying just now on the streets of Bristol, is that there's not that much difference between the three main parties anyway, the New Labour, Liberal Democrat and Conservative.
Well, that's perception.
Yeah, I think as we go forward and we're talking about serious language of priorities in a crisis, the splits between the parties will become quite acute. So it's not going to be that easy to cobble together any kind of coalition, whoever wins the election.
How long was it here in Bristol, Chris, that it took the Labour and Liberal administration to come to an agreement about how to run it, when we had a similar thing here in Bristol where we had a hung council election?
Yeah, the problem with that sort of thing is that
it went on for months, didn't it?
Yeah, it's very, very difficult to pin blame on anybody for what goes wrong when you're in that situation. And I think the same would apply to national government. It took a long time in Bristol with it going backwards and forwards between the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats. And whichever way the Conservatives voted, and I like to think that they voted as far as the people were concerned, they were then blamed for siding with the opposite side. Not a nice position to be in. And there again, it just reinforces what I say. A hung parliament, I feel, would be a very, very bad thing for the country.
So you'll be very happy if Mr. Brown stays in number 10 then?
No, I haven't got that special sign across the top of my forehead.
No, okay. Gordon Brown with a majority then? You'd be happier than that than a hung parliament.
I would rather see Gordon Brown in power with a clear mandate than I would see a hung parliament. On a basis that I don't think he'd last very long, and there'd be a change of government then.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, on to a big international story now from The New Scientist, and questions have been raised over the number of deformities found in young children in Fallujah, Iraq, after a paediatrician told the BBC that there are two or three cases each day in one hospital. There was rather a harrowing report a couple of nights ago on Newsnight as well about this. In 2004, Fallujah was the scene of heavy fighting in which the US military eventually regained control of the city. Local people told the BBC that they suspect the US forces used white phosphorus, which was also, I believe, used in the Gaza conflict at the beginning of last year, and depleted uranium, although this has not been proven. DU, depleted uranium, is a dense metal used in armour-piercing shells. It's both radioactive and toxic, and has been linked to lung cancer and kidney failure. But the evidence is not conclusive, apparently, and a US study in 2005 found that it should not cause cancer or birth defects. Now, do you believe that report, Martin? Do you want to start on this one?
Well, I mean...
We all know,
they would say that, wouldn't they? I mean, it's just another one of the pernicious consequences of what we're talking about at the beginning of the show, which was this decision to invade Iraq.
This depleted uranium, for those that haven't come across it, it actually is a nuclear waste byproduct from our nuclear reactors. And although many people say it's very, very little radiation in it, there are lots of different types of depleted uranium. What happens is when uranium is refined, if you want to call it that, and I think it's U-238, is taken out to use in reactors, we're left with a whole chunk of less radioactive uranium, which is then considered to be waste. Now, if that's been through the reprocessing at Sellafield, it can also contain all sorts of very nasty man-made chemicals, what are called actinides, things like americium, beryllium, and very radioactive. So I think whenever you hear that depleted uranium is very unradioactive, you should be very, very suspicious about that. Anyway, what are your thoughts, Chris, about the use of these weapons in Fallujah and whether or not they may be related to the deformities in children being born there?
Well, I think the use of these sort of weapons is horrendous wherever they're used. I really cannot see any excuse for using these sort of weapons which will have repercussions for perhaps generations in families. Yes, we need weapons. I wouldn't say we shouldn't use weapons, because sometimes we need weapons to defend ourselves, our way of life and our families. But I do think that some of these weapons and depleted uranium, white phosphorus and various other things that have been used, I think they're awful. I think they're terrible. I'd like to see them banned worldwide.
Yeah, I think the other thing that tends to go on is people say, hey, they want a war, and what should happen if you're going to fight a war in a moral way is you've got to be prepared to take the casualties. Don't call in an airstrike when you're in a civilian area. You're going to have to take those casualties if you want a war, and if you don't want to fight like that, you shouldn't start it.
Well, many of these depleted uranium shells are actually don't come from above, do they?
No, the assault on Fallujah was the biggest armoured assault on an urban area since World War II, and you know what? It took 6 months for them to get into the centre of the town, because brave defenders held them back with small arms for 6 months. And the Americans have only got one way to fight, which is to send in the tanks. And of course, you can't get your tanks into a city like that. And they were actually taught a lesson by the resistance in Fallujah.
It does seem. I mean, I remember when the BBC were reporting this story yesterday, they didn't actually make reference, as they were reporting it, to depleted uranium. They were just talking about certain types of weapons and sort of tiptoeing around the idea
uranium is used in tank shells because it's got a very heavy tip, so it's an armour-piercing tip. But if you fire that into an urban area full of women, children and families, it's likely to cause... It's designed for knocking out a Russian tank on the German plane, not for firing into a major city in the Middle East.
And the strange thing about depleted uranium is that it would have to be, the nuclear companies would have to pay a fantastic amount to have it disposed of as nuclear waste, but no, they found a way to sell it to the military. It's rather scary stuff. Anyway, we're just coming up now towards the Sky News at 6 o'clock. I'd just like to say thank you very much to this week's guest, who's Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows. After the news, we have The Secret of Oz, which is a new film from the United States. It looks at the financial allegories contained in the famous book by William Baum, The Wizard of Oz, and asks if there are lessons for today's financial crisis. And Montpellier-based Falklands veteran Richard Cowley asks, what is the difference between a soldier and a terrorist? Thanks, Chris, for joining us. And you can join us after the news.
93.2. BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.